All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Great Lakes Permaculture Design Collaborative Podcast.
I'm Milton Dixon, and I'm here with
William Faith.
And I'm Rhonda Baird.
And we've been getting together
as a teaching collaborative across three states.
The podcast is there to answer a lot of questions while also inspiring a deeper level of inquiry.
To bring ideas and information to people as they're exploring permaculture and implementing it.
So, welcome. GLPDC.info.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. I'm here with my colleagues, Rhonda Baird and Milton Dixon. And today we're going to be discussing access to land. It's sort of our collective view that one of the things that keeps communities from building true wealth in a lot of cases is land and access to it. We experience difficulty with any number of projects owing to who owns the land, who has access to land, the kind of permissions that you need to run through in order to move projects forward. So our discussion today is around that and what sort of strategies and techniques we can employ to try to ameliorate that and make things a little bit more horizontal and accessible overall. So with that, what are your individual views on access to land?
I was thinking that there's like an initial decision point to make. Are we going to respect property rights and law, or are we not going to? I think if we're not going to, it has its own set of problems, own set of strategies that you would take in that situation. And then if we're going to work within the system, how do we do that? So I don't know if we want to spend a little time talking about one of the, I was thinking the more radical one. Maybe we should give it like a short little bit of time, but then go to the working, keeping within the system a little bit more. I don't know what you guys think about that. Maybe we can give it the whole time if you want, but.
No, I hear what you're saying. Like the house we lived in before this one, 18 or 20 years ago, there was the right across the street from us, there was a little plot of land that was along the railroad tracks, but far enough away that it was kind of grassy and I don't even know if anyone mowed it or anything. And then we were there for like 2 years. We were renting at that point and we had somebody in the neighborhood, you know, it's kind of an edgy neighborhood. And there was somebody that planted a strip of vegetables. I'm not even sure who did it or when it happened, but there they were. And I thought that was pretty fantastic. That they were just taking advantage of a piece of land that no one else was using.
As the token anarchist of the group, I have a pretty negative view of the concept of private property, and this is not something that people get to decide. You're just kind of stuck with it. And so consequently, anything that draws some power back toward people, I'm generally all in favor of. So when I see things like Via Campesina and other movements like that, where people are taking back land and using it, the whole Occupy Wall Street movement is just a fantastic concept that I was all about in the spirit of the thing. But at the same time, there's the current moment and paradigm that we're in. And while squatted efforts are really, really cool. And right now, I mean, there's an autonomous zone in Seattle, you know, at this exact moment, which I'm all about. However, in all likelihood, at some point, probably pretty quickly, that's going to get shut down. And while everyone's spirits will have been lifted for the effort, I mean, there's reflections of the Paris Commune there. Then what? That's always the question. What happens next? And for any autonomous effort, for every temporary autonomous zone that people are able to put together, every piece of land that they're able to reclaim for a time, eventually those things get wrested back out of their hands and we're kind of back at square one. So my question, the thing that I'm always trying to solve in this is what steps can we take to tweak our current situation to more closely resemble that, to make things more horizontal and accessible to everyone? To make access to land fairer and accessible. That's really what it boils down to.
You know, in some ways there's an element of How much are you risking? When you play by the rules, when you're in the system, most of the time, you're not risking the farm, right? Literally. But if you're squatting, you get shut down, you lose everything. Someone asserts their ownership of it, kind of a wild west, but when they have the big guns of the man, then you lose. For me, foraging is kind of the least risky because you can get in and get out and take whatever your stash is. I think it's still important to respect the space that you're working within and respect the plants and all the people. I wouldn't recommend foraging your neighbors with the gun protecting his land. That might cause you some problems. I don't know. But there are a lot of times like, hey, there's these service berries in front of this office building that nobody's paying attention to. So yeah, that would be kind of the place I would start foraging, dipping my toe into that realm. And you can continue that as you play the other game, right? You can play both worlds at the same time. I think that's important. It's not one or the other.
And in many places on public lands, there are certain things that you are allowed to, or even encouraged to, forage periodically. So, you know, near a wildlife refuge where we were looking for mushrooms and picking berries and harvesting, you know, persimmons, things like that all the time. You know, we had some acreage, we had a garden that supplemented our diet and was a big part of our family culture growing up. So those things are available. That development of the commons is an important strategy, I think, you know, looking at. Seen a successful community orchard project in my own community develop and go through different iterations. It's a lot of work, and for volunteers to tend the project, and it does yield a lot of fruit. The agreements around that in terms of who accesses the fruit, how it gets tended, you know, that can be, you can start to question why the yield really is, if it's enough of a yield, but it is a strategy. And I think one that can be employed a lot more, yeah, in terms of access.
On the question of squatting, I think that one perspective that we can employ is that if you really break it down, everything we're doing is squatting, being that we're on stolen land to begin with. The First Peoples have a very different perspective on all this. So this is actually squatting on large scale, squatting in mass. But at the same time, in this exact current paradigm, I want to circle back to what Rhonda was just saying on commoning. An urgent need to sort of re-common as many of these areas as possible. Mm-hmm. And to the question of what you were saying about how much does each group get, et cetera, et cetera. This is where we also have to employ a communication strategy. And so we have these social technology that we've obviously been barking about for some time now, but we're definitely able to put together really, really functional tools to enable that. And so trying to avoid that tragedy of the commons kind of thing, that's where communication comes to the center of all that. And as you both know, this is something I make a lot of noise about, it, is that whatever our lofty goals, without having really, really solid communication, none of it happens. It's all based on that part. And so I think that that's at the center of just about everything that we do.
Mm-hmm. I would add to it communication, but also the decision-making, the governance, I think is connected to that deeply. And that also has, for me, a perspective of, well, where do I belong and who do I belong to and how do we make decisions? Because that is really clear then that I belong to a community, that I have a voice in that community, and that we are governing our resources together collectively. Then we can talk about social tools for that in a way that's meaningful. The community orchard I was just talking about is a few acres, mature trees, things producing all the time, lots and lots of volunteer hours. And the thing is that you can harvest anything that's ripe, but only for immediate consumption there. Like, I can't harvest a bushel to take home and put up of applesauce, which seems pretty fair. But they've done a really good job, that particular project, of increasing and educating and replicating orchards all around the community so other people have access to food as well and more food security. But the whole city couldn't eat from that orchard, you know. So more land and production for sure, and access to that. Who gets to access that land?
If you're not going to do it, you know, buy your bootstraps, work your butt off, earn the money, buy the land outright, or whatever mortgage payment, you know, death pledge you want to do. It really is going to involve people, social agreements, you know, talking to people, sitting down, acquiescing to what their views are so that you can get your stuff going on within their schema, right? And that can happen in all sorts of different ways. I manage 64 acres of a cooperative. It's the back acreage of a residential addiction treatment facility. And they've kind of got their projects going on, but they're just not up to doing stuff with this land. So we've kind of created a cooperative, and that's a whole thing right there, getting along with people, working together, mm-hmm. and still working within then what the place Don Farm wants. Mm-hmm. You know, not pushing into their territory, but also we try to have the view that we're all stewarding the place mm-hmm. for them, because it's also, you know, it's a very vulnerable community. And to be able to take care of that. And then hopefully on down the road, the idea is that we'll be able to make connections. But we can't make connections until there's things happening, mm-hmm. right? So we have to have things to connect to.
There's a few things to unpack from that. One is, can I get access to the land? And we live in a society where some people get access to land easier than others. And the land that they get access to, not all that land is equal, right? Sometimes it's polluted or
Superfund sites
or dry lands, you know, or no access to water. Sure, you can have access to the land, but you can't harvest water here or have access to any source of water. You have to bring it in. That's something I've seen a couple of times. So that's one whole topic. And then like another one is that sometimes landowners, they retain all these rights and responsibilities. And when a group comes to them, that group needs to be really clear about its vision and its unfolding and responsibility with that. And in that, then, is sometimes an issue of financing. So, for example, a married couple might be able to access loans and credit in one particular way, whereas a corporation would be able to access it in a different way. Whereas a nonprofit would have other issues, and cooperatives or even informal group agreements would have a whole other set of considerations around financing a bigger project than maybe they have the capital to or resources to implement. And so those are all barriers to access to land in my experience.
I hear all that. 100%. That was a question I had for you, Milton, was how is the land out at Don Farm held?
The nonprofit Don Farm Incorporated, or whatever it is, owns it outright.
So the 501c3 owns it straight?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, that's definitely one technique for holding land. Another one that I'm a big fan of, I know I've talked about this during courses a lot, but community land trusts, I think, have a lot to offer. A pretty fantastic technique for holding land and making it available in particular, because I think that one of the reasons it's done so well, and it's such a slow rollout in the grand scheme of things, but Chicago's tried it, and the city has undertaken, it's the Chicago Community Land Trust, which apparently dates back some time. I think 2006, I want to say, was when it first kind of started rolling. And then it's had a spotty history subsequent to that. I've just doing some digging on it over the last couple of days, and it's definitely fits and starts with some dicey things. Chicago, go fig. But at the same time, conceptually, I think it really has a lot to offer, in as much as the community land trust owns the land, but the person occupying the space owns or rents the house. And one of the primary things that I think it can offer is that it hits that spot between renting and ownership. And also, there's usually the one major hurdle that I think stops people from getting into land is that big down payment that's usually required to get into a home. And this eliminates that barrier. So the difference between a rent and a mortgage is often quite minimal, particularly if you're keeping the sort of same density of people in the space. So that can make a massive difference for people. There's that sort of very tenuous, almost transient feeling to renting. You're reluctant to do anything permanent because you could pull up stakes and roll at any time. For some folks, that's a very common reality of life, is having to pull up and move really regularly, in some cases multiple times a year. It's very difficult to have long-term plans and to design for anything lasting when you're in those situations. So consequently, things tend to feel very moment to moment, whereas this provides that opportunity to get that 99-year lease on a spot of land and actually become wedded to place in a meaningful way. And so that's one of the things that I've found most promising. Have either of you had any perspectives on that?
On land trust?
Yes.
Corbin's family farm is held in land trust.
And what's that experience been like?
He has a very minimal role in it, and he's not farming it. We would be farming it very differently than it's farmed.
Sure.
And we have, but there's that sort of that family history that's connected, and that sense of belonging to the land and knowing that it's held, as you know, in agricultural trust, and you know, it's an identity, right? So I don't know what your experience with land trust, Milton.
Not a whole lot. I know a person that lived in one, and that's about it. The Vale in the Yellow Springs.
And did they have any experience that was worth sharing, or anything that they told you about what it was like?
No, other than it was a property that was kind of outside of town and walking to town and things that I don't think are specifically in relationship to the fact that it's in a land trust. Yeah. I did a thing, you know, once when you sent out that email, William, about what this was, I took the permaculture flower and I filtered it through the concept of ownership. I mean, because we're talking about doing that in the primer anyway, right? So I was like, well, what's going to happen with this? It really seems to me to be about decision-making ability. Like, who decides? Who decides what's going to happen? Who gets the products of, it's that who's in charge? You know, I went through the whole thing, the buildings and tools and tech and things like deeds and, you know, plat maps or county GIS as tools to view who owns what. And even things like intellectual property and copyright. In health and spirit, I was thinking about the continuum of anarchism to slavery, like an ownership or a relationship, that you interact with these beings and you have an ownership over them, or you have a relationship with them.
With the land?
With the land, yeah, with the trees. Mm-hmm. Because even getting past that, well, I own this and it's mine, finances and economics. I mean, ultimately, do you ever own anything if you're paying taxes on it? And then having productive assets that are reproductive assets, right, the kind of gradations there. And you own the things that you use. If you don't use it, do you really own it? Right? Or even maybe even changing that word. Is there a way that we can change that word, ownership? Redefine the whole concept of it, because if you know, if you own it but you never see it, you never touch it, you never interact with it, there's no relationship other than this ownership, whatever paper, you know, thing.
I think an interesting exercise is to substitute the word belong.
Yeah.
Do I belong to this land?
Do you guys belong to your houses, your homes? Do you belong to them?
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, and for me, similar exercise, Rhonda, that I use is, for me, it's always the word stewardship. That's the one that I kind of use, that I'm stewarding a piece of land, or I'm stewarding a home, or I'm in relation to that thing for a period of time. And also realizing that it's temporary. And of course, that's not a popular concept, because for a couple of reasons. One, people don't like being confronted with the fact that at some point this too shall pass. And then there's the whole additional layers of complexity around heirs and ownership and refer next of kin and so on and so forth on down the line. And so much of our legal entanglements are based around those exact things and probate sales and all these things that follow. Whereas if we, you know, the concept of the 99-year lease is what I'm a huge fan of. I think that that's almost some sort of center point between true commoning, where the land is equitably distributed, to private property and private ownership. Mm-hmm. And so this is that kind of spot in between where people are getting their minds around the fact that it's like, I'm occupying this space and using it for a set period of time. And so it's a very different mental place, I think, to be in, and a healthy one ultimately.
Yeah, I agree. I think I was sitting with this while I was listening to Milton, which I really like how you approach that. And I heard ownership. It was bringing to mind, well, I want to own this thing so that I can control it, so that I feel secure about what I'm building for my future and how I want my life to go, which is great to have plans. I'm not saying don't do that or have goals, but the need to control and squeeze the maximum yield out for your own self to the detriment of everything else around you. And people talk about leaving something for their heirs, but many times they don't.
Control.
Yeah, it's absolutely that. I think that one of the things that you run into with this is that people tend to, in the absence of community, people turn to the self. And so if you're not really anchored with a large group of people, that's when people tend to silo and become very individualistic and fixated on controlling their environment. Whereas if I look to, I mean, we were just talking about this, other cultures, where the house is almost the end result. It's the people that fill it that make it what it is. Mm-hmm. So it's less about the structure and more about the people that occupy it. In Latin cultures in particular, I found that that's absolutely true. And I just don't see that same kind of self-centered thing rolling out there, where people are safe rooms and all these like very individual home theater systems and really like dialed in, very specific, fit to your every need approaches to things. Not that I'm above fixating on my own personal needs from time to time, but at the same time, there's a balance there, I think. And I think these things tend to run a little bit wild with people who don't necessarily have or focus on those connections.
Yeah. Maybe we should do a follow-up conversation on access to people.
Right. Right.
Just access to people. There's really something about community, and there's something there that's been going on in my head and really been coming into focus during these past few months because I've been missing people, right? Mm-hmm. There's been a lot less connection with people, and I think it's revealing some things that weren't as apparent before.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's also two sides to that same coin, where you've got the people that are very sort of, that, and it's to do with economics and where you are and on the financial spectrum, but the people who have money build these extravagant mega mansions with all their personal needs into. On the other end, people with less means hoard. And so that's kind of the other end of it, where you'll see people trying to fill that place in their life that used to be filled with people or family or something like that. They switch over to trying to take care of it through this sort of consumer on steroids kind of mindset. But all of it points to this sort of hollow center that ultimately is, I think, meant to be filled by people, friends, family, community. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm down to talk about that for sure.
Yeah, and access to land is critically important for providing for our needs, or just our basic needs. And land distribution has been an age-old question, especially in the United States of America. I just started listening to Henry David Thoreau again on Walden Pond. And it reminds me also of Henry George and his 1 acre policy, where he wanted to see every person have an acre of land that they could do with whatever they wanted to, tax free. And it's something we've struggled with. And as there's been greater and greater disparity in this country, the access to land, as more and more people move to urban environments, population density, access to land, it's an important question for everyone to consider.
None of this floats if you don't have a place to be. That's kind of the Act One, Scene One part of it for me. On that hierarchy of needs, once you get above your own physiological functioning, having a roof over your head is central to our overall function.
Yep.
And yeah, I think that a huge part of the conversation is moving forward towards some of these techniques and strategies to meet those needs.
I really appreciate this opportunity to work with these two folks. And one of the things that we get to do together is to put on permaculture design courses.
We put together an awesome design course. We're very, very proud of what we've done. It's different than a lot of other design courses we've seen. And I think that one of the strongest points that we have going is the chemistry between the three of us. There's three very different voices communicating how you receive that information. It's going to differ for everybody. And that's one of the real strengths of this, I feel, is because we're coming from three different walks of life, but we're all connected on the central point. As someone enrolled in the course, you're the beneficiary of that. So this is a definite opportunity to acquire knowledge and insight that will help you in the days ahead.
And you can hear more of our banter in our introductory permaculture course. It's a survey of the topics that we cover in the PDC.
We took the video cliff notes for most of the sections of the PDC that we created together and put them out to see if they could support people's permaculture learning.
So it's free to check out, and you can see what every student would see.
So they're up to you to watch and journey for any new insights from and put that into practice.
And also, if you want to get a condensed version or an opportunity to ask some questions of some of what we do here, we are doing a permaculture primer online. So there's information down in the show notes. So just go look there. There'll be a link for that. We're doing a 90-minute introductory walkthrough where we can go into some of that information and you get the opportunity to ask questions. So if you can join us for that, that would be great.
glpdc.info.